My name is Lynn Olson. Today's date is July 15, 1991, and the following is the second part of an interview with Dr. Andrew Olson. Professor Olson was professor of zoology at SDSU from 1946 to 1980.
That's the idea, yeah.
We may not be able to do anything with it immediately, but eventually we'll get to it.
Uh-huh. Oh, well,
that's the way it is always with archives.
Well, that's the way it is with in my library here, in my files, too.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to get back on the track here and talk about your early years at SDSU as an instructor. You told me a little bit about how you were hired. You simply filled out a form. You didn't have any direct interview.
I had written back in 1941 from Idaho, but not knowing what was going to be happening in the World War situation. I wrote down and to Dr. Heppner asking if there were any positions available. That letter was written at the request of Dr. Myrtle Johnson, who was head of the biology at that time, and she talked to Dr. Harwood, whose assistant reader I had been as a student, and he wrote to me and suggested that I write the letter to Dr. Heppner, but as he indicated, there were no openings and nothing available then. But I kept in touch with Dr. Harwood through the while I was in the service, and in the spring of when I saw that I was going to be getting out, spring of 46, I made contacted him, and he said to apply, and then Dr. Heppner approved and so on, so I started in September of 46.
Had it ever occurred to you to apply to other institutions as well?
That's interesting. I'm going through some correspondence just yesterday. I ran across a letter from a Dr. E. Raymond Hall at Berkeley, who had written four letters of recommendation, one to Berkeley, the school, but his one remark that stuck in my mind was, I'm surprised that you didn't apply at Harvard. But at any rate, it's pretty hard to be coming back to your own hometown. I would give that preference, certainly. But I did have the disadvantage of not having a doctorate. I had the master's degree, but still had the doctorate to go. Mm-hmm. And so with my being hired here, it was essentially sort of on a temporary basis with the assumption that it would be made permanent with when I got the doctorate. That's why I left in 1950 and took the year off and started my work at Oregon State, which was completed over a period of time then, finally granted in 1955.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty fast, actually.
And it was that time that I was able to get up to, I think it was associate professor, whatever, and then finally full professor, and went through the department chairmanships and so on.
Uh-huh. Was the department a challenge for you when you first started here? I mean, I would imagine you're young, you're jumping in with both feet, and you want to see things move and see things develop. Did you have some grandiose ideas when you first joined?
Not necessarily, no. Well, too busy teaching and keeping up with things. That was still very much what I was familiar with from the, 38 and 39 times when I had been working with general zoology, anyhow, with Dr. Harwood. Mm-hmm. And when I started here, my prime teaching was in the general zoology. So it was something I was familiar with, and I saw no reason for making any changes in that. Mm-hmm. But then gradually I was able to developed my own couple courses that became more or less my own, the field zoology in the summer and a parasitology course.
Well, you developed those two courses later on. Do you recall what courses you taught when you first started working here?
General zoology and general biology. We had a 10A, 10B, essentially laboratory by teaching at that time.
Okay. Were you a good instructor? All the way through?
Well, I was a hard-working one. I certainly tried, particularly those early years, which were my challenging years, getting my feet wet. Although I had 2 years as a teaching fellow at the University of Idaho, and that set me up for the lab work and much of the things that go on in teaching is up there. Instead of having 24 students in the laboratory, we had laboratory set up for 50. Mm. And when I began, Dr. Pratt, who eventually became a doctoral, I got my doctorate under, just turned me loose in the class, and I had taught the first day with teaching amoeba fresh materials, how to use a microscope and all, by myself to 50 students. In fact, he let me take full control. He would come in occasionally during the semester, and they would refer to him as Mr. Pratt, and I was Dr. Olson, because I was the one that had to make all the decisions. When students went to him with a question, they said, "Well, ask Olson."
He's teaching you directly.
So I had
that's good experience.
Really got my feet wet. The interesting thing here was the real challenge, because it was after the war. The students had missed 2, 3, 4, 5 years out of their lives, and they were out to make up for lost time. And they were very eager. They were good. There were no discipline problems. And you just put out the work, and the students went to it, and they asked challenging questions. It was the most interesting teaching that I ever had. Those late 40 years were the most challenging and most interesting teaching, busy life.
That's what I've heard other people say too, that the students that were entering school then were really gung ho.
And we were here to teach. We had to be on campus 5 days a week. We had an office, had to have an office hour scheduled every day. And not like now, as things are so different, really.
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Did you have much time to pursue any of your own research then? Or were you spending,
time? Particularly in the sciences, for our laboratory teaching, we got 2 hours credit for teaching a 3-hour lab. Mm-hmm. So we put in 16 hours. I was putting in 16 hours of actual student contact work, compared to the straight lecturers who put in 12 hours.
Yeah, you put in many more hours then. Mm-hmm. I have this down on my list of questions here, but I'm not so sure I should ask it. I'll ask it anyway. You can discard it if you want. Which classrooms did you use early on?
Well, we were in the life sciences. The biology buildings. It was it was the science building, really, because that training school that was occupying what is now physical sciences. So, we had was off to the north side. East of the library. There's the downstairs portion was astronomy, and we had biology labs there. Then on the first floor was the zoology and botany labs. Upstairs were geology, physics, chemistry.
Mm-hmm. And it was pretty compact.
Very definitely.
Yeah.
So we were a little world in ourselves there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were chair from 1957 to 80, I see.
And no, to 60. Just 3 years.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, I wrote down 80 for some reason.
No, it's only three. We,
of course, that would be impossible.
We all took our turns.
You retired in 80.
took our turns at 3 year uh-huh. stints.
Did anything spectacular happen when you were chair that you remember? Or were things pretty run of the mill?
By that time, things were really quite stable.
Mm-hmm.
I think of no great challenges. My time there had nice, good people to work with, a good staff, and no rumblings I remember.
Mm-hmm. How do you compare, earlier on in zoology, I would imagine the 50s and 60s, you really had spurts of growth for the department, and after that time period, it probably slowed down considerably. Do you see the difference in the way it grew because of administrative changes on campus and the way things are done, the way that the bureaucracy works? Was it any easier to get things through earlier on than it was in the 70s and 80s?
Seems though we had much more autonomy. Things that tended to lead to change were the way the quotas were set, and where the FTEs, the enrollment, there's various factors that entered into how much money was going to be appropriated, how much a classroom space. This is one of the things that where we went to the biological sciences instead of having a separate zoology and botany course.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. Where you could have large lecture sections, you're able to generate a lot of FTEs. In the laboratory, we got just a two-thirds credit for toward FTEs and so on. There was much to be gained by having large lecture sections.
Hmm.
And then by having large lecture sections, you could get larger classrooms, in some cases, which were needed. Then there was the competition for funds in between, say, the large biology sections and the zoology sections, which were so important to pre-med students and so on. And some of that thought could be, the problems could be resolved by having a biological sciences department rather than separate departments.
So that's one of the reasons why this change occurred. I think it was in 84, 85,
mm-hmm.
was the last year that zoology was its own department.
Yeah, so there are a number of factors involved. Students applying to professional schools, some of the schools preferred to see biology major rather than a zoology major, so on. There are many factors. And then with new faculty that come, some of them came from schools that had biology rather than separate zoology and botany departments. And that's what they were used to, so they encouraged the development of the biology or biological sciences department.
I was wondering what it was that caused this change.
You know, there are a number of factors. Okay. We had meeting after meeting and discussion after discussion. And
I would guess it wouldn't be an easy transition to make.
There were a lot of feelings involved at the time.
Yeah. Well, you had been around and watched the zoology department really grow.
Mm-hmm.
And had seen considerable changes in the zoology department. It must have been hard on you, for one, to see this change occur.
Right.
It might have been kind of hard,
mm-hmm.
I would imagine, because it's such a large part of your life.
You have to sort of roll with the punches and realize that times are changing. And because
mm-hmm.
over the years, I found that, checking back, I'd involved with 16 different courses. So those are the days when we couldn't, we had more or less had to do that in order to accommodate the students' interests and needs. And we put a lot of that in front of what was most comfortable for us.
That's right, yeah. You were thinking of the students first.
Yeah.
The students come first. It's changed a little bit nowadays, hasn't it?
That.
Who are some of the movers and shakers in the zoology department? Who are the instrumental people that made things develop and change, and who led the way?
Well, of course, I think of Harwood and Crouch, who maintained a lot of stability. There might have been individuals who would have liked to make some changes, but we had such, well, what some of us thought was such a smooth running thing. We didn't want to upset the apple cart.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I just should not mention names, but there's certain individuals anyhow who made some changes, and again in biology, and it worked for you, operated for a year or two, but found that it was not successful. We then went back to a lot of our old ways.
Mm-hmm.
There was some experimenting and attempts to modify to keep some people happy, but they soon found that some of those things did not work, and some of the well-established courses and curricula really were more effective. At least that was my view of it.
You were probably time-proven too.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, later some of the later changes that we have now, I think, tend to be working out pretty well. I think now of Dr. Al Johnson retiring as vice president for academic affairs. I remember when he was first hired, this one. I sat next to him at biology department meetings. And there again, when we had this, one of those changes, one was around 70, when did he come? 72? Well, anyhow, we had, opted to either go into the biology department or the zoology department, which was still identified as such. And at the time, I was teaching Biology 4, which was a natural history of plants and animals course, and it was a big part of my schedule. And with my having had zoology and zoology major and botany minor through my degrees, I thought of myself as a biologist. But then I was in I got into the biology department and found that that I was much more at home in the zoology department, and so I, after a year, I moved back to zoology. But anyhow, I can say that Dr. Johnson was a very stable person, made very good contributions in the department meetings, and of course was so well thought of. He became what, dean of life sciences or whatever? No, he was dean, but chairman of the life sciences department or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then on up to his vice presidentship. And he's been a very good, stable person. Made very fine contributions.
Oh, yeah. He's been good very instrumental in holding campus together.
Tremendous respect for him.
Well, since you're talking about Al Johnson, how about any other individuals on campus that we know all the big names and stuff, but who in particular stands out in your mind as being a particularly influential person?
Well, even a lot of people, again, who were leveling and helped, give the campus a good personality. Back in the later 40s, Dean C.E. Peterson. We had the Peterson Gym named for him. Always have to mention Jack Adams, Dr. John Adams, who has his building named for him. When I was involved with the Senate and the Senate Personnel Committee and involved with reports that were somewhat touchy, well, worked closely with both Ned Joy and Dr. Kramer Roefleisch. Kramer Roefleisch was a very helpful person for writing up reports that were to go to the Senate to make sure that they were things were correctly stated. We could have a meeting of the Personnel Committee or whatever, and he would have the assignment to write up what our report would be to the Senate at the next meeting.
I don't know how he ever found the time to do what he did. He seemed to, I've interviewed him. He's really quite an active person.
Oh, you bet.
Back then.
And he's still enjoying his music, and he comes to the Anthony's thing on Tuesdays.
Good.
Herbert Pfeiffer, we have Pfeiffer Lounge, and
tell me
about people that just kept the campus in order, like Ned Joy. These are people that made the presidents look good. They were the they took the brunt of so many things. They're the ones that met with the students and the populace on occasions and had to and defended the president. Really, and kept things on an even keel here.
Are you thinking of one instance in particular, defending the president?
Well, not
specifically
I'm
Joy,
sure,
possibly.
Well, a number of times. This campus decisions where might have been if there was faculty unrest or something. It was things were calmed down by people. It didn't have to be handled by the president. But there was the one case of course, a strike when the students went on strike in the administration building. Then they were actually physically standing in the doorways to head them off.
Yeah, that must have been quite a day.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that. Well, President Love had quite a way about him. Also, there was some student protest that was happening over in the open air theater. I'm just remembering that somebody told me about this a long time ago, and the students were chanting and getting progressively angrier or something, and all President Love had to do was stand up in front of the class and, or in front of the crowd of people and just say a couple of words, and it calmed them completely down.
Uh-huh.
And that was it. He said something like, we're here for you, or something like that. Something, mm-hmm. And that was it. Do you think that Love must have had quite an aura about him?
Well, he was one who let committees do a lot of the work. He involved other people in the decisions. He would take the final responsibility, but he himself, let's see. I've got another compilation here.
Did I take it away already?
No, this is, I have a list of things that I was involved with through a particular time. That is on campus. Kind of a schedule that I had, This is back 1958, 59. These are little. We had sort of update our files. It's called an administration file. I guess it was up. I think it was kept by the president's office. We had to turn in each year, which would be a great source of information for you hope.
It would be.
But in, let's see. Oh, in 1963-64, let's see, I was president of AAUP, and we had the president's liaison council. He took the president of AAUP, CSEA, ACSUP, and one of the, I think there were about four of us that would meet with him. Well, problems arose. Maybe once a month we'd have a regular meeting with him. See, at that time I was on the College Senate, Senate Executive Committee, Senate Personnel Committee, the President's Liaison Council, and then a College Grievance and Ethical Practices Committee. Now that, I think, that was a sort of an interim thing. As I recall it, we had the first grievance that came up by a
the
faculty
first
member.
Was when, in 63-64?
This would be 63-64.
Boy, did they ever flourish after that.
When President Love called our, this president of the liaison council, presidents then of these different associations together and made us the, I guess it was the first grievance committee. And this is what I chaired that, but here's where Ned Joy was a big help. He had knew more of the legalese and helped to keep the conduct of the grievance hearing.
So this was the beginning. This liaison council was the beginning of the the grievance committee.
This was the first one.
Huh.
It was and sort of an ad hoc type I forget, an interim committee. I was it was President Love's method, at any rate, for handling the situation.
Good example.
He called
the way
upon
he would set up
the
a committee.
President's and his liaison council and. Turn that over to us, and in the actually in the case, the individual we went for the individual faculty member against the department. The individual went on, became a very successful, continued on as a very successful professor in the department.
Can you say who it was?
No.
Or would you prefer not to?
I shouldn't. I saw him at a meeting. Well, he attended. He attended the meeting or the memorial service for Polly and Bernie Kirby, which was a couple Sundays ago. That's as far as I'll
all
go.
I can do is guess.
I don't think there's any need to, because I'm in an awkward position because the person who was for the department chairman at the time is a very good friend now.
Oh, really?
So, but anyhow, it all worked out amicably. There was a good justification on both sides,
mm-hmm.
and as I say. It all worked out.
What other interesting committee developments can you tell me about that Love may have started, or that maybe Love didn't start but occurred anyway?
I don't know. Of course, the big thing in his time was the Academic Senate, the formulation of that.
Mm-hmm.
San Diego. Through the years, San Diego State has led the way in so many of these new things in the old state system.
Yeah.
Now, but I look at this, what it, in the 1963-4 year, of course it was complicated by being president of AUP, you automatically got other things, but I was on the Senate Executive Committee, Senate Personnel Committee. These were of things that apparently went along with being president of AAUP.
Oh.
Yeah. This is the Grievance and Ethical Practices Committee, College Tenure Review Committee, the Arts and Sciences Council. Well, that was Sidney Gulick. I think Sidney Gulick was had that. Biology Curriculum Committee, Biology Promotion and Tenure Committee, President of AUP, Faculty Advisor for Alpha Phi Omega, Consultant in Parasitology at Sharp Hospital, and then other, put down your other local and statewide activities, too numerous to mention.
You
that
did
was
all
a busy
that
year.
In 1 year?
This was, that
That's
was a busy
lot.
Year. These were, President Love asked me, he said, well, you
do you teach?
Relief. I had the classes too. And